This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The Goat's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
Hello, my lovelies. It is time once again for another episode of Liner Note Leftovers, your virtual crate digging experience that hopefully leaves you knowing a little bit more about your favorite songs and albums than you did before. Tonight's episode is called the 12-inch special, you know, because it's episode 12 and a record is 12 inches long. What did you think I was talking about when I said the 12-inch special? Wait. Before you answer that, get your mind out of the gutter because I'm going to tell you what we're actually talking about. We are talking about all the sexy excitement of parking lots. There's more to it than that. It involves Judas Priest, a documentary you might have seen yourself in. It's actually pretty awesome. We're doing an exercise in self-sabotage with Jim Morrison, and I know what you're thinking. Which one? Well, we'll just see when we get there. Oh, and by the way, if you're a rock star who shares their name with a disgraced MI6 agent who sold USSR secrets, you might want to watch for that if you're going through a Russian airport. I'm not saying you got to change your name, but maybe bring a note or something. I don't know. All that and more coming up on Liner Note Leftovers. Let's get right into it. Drop that needle. If you've ever sung along to the Numa Numa song, secretly done a Fortnite dance when no one is watching, or are currently scrolling through your billionth cat meme video, I see you, baby, you're doing it right now, you can maybe thank Heavy Metal Parking Lot, which was filmed on May 31st, 1986, and is widely believed to be one of the first viral videos of all time, despite the fact there not being a thing called internet in the large majority of homes at the time. So how did it all go down? Well, back in 1986, two directors, John Hayne and Jeff Krulik, aspiring filmmakers, set out to make a short documentary, a time capsule of the era, so to speak. And they figure what better to encapsulate the heavy metal MTV times, quite like just filming outside the Capitol Center Arena in Largo, Maryland, at a Dokken Judas Priest show. Mind you, they have no plan, a handy cam, no questions writ up, they're just gonna, all right, let's see where this goes. And 90% of the video is like this.
Dokken to the dome! Love it till the morning. I'm gone. I'm gone. Yeah, I know. Hey, let me tell you something.
Where are you from?
Greece is the best, man. Greece is the best. I'm telling you. Hey, let me tell you. Robert Halford is the best.
But it ended up becoming sort of a cult classic because a lot of metal fans saw themselves in this video. Sometimes that was figurative and sometimes that was, hey, that was me, man. Those were those guys that lied to me and said they were from MTV. Now, because it was just a 16-minute short documentary, it got no theater release. It was just making the rounds on burnt VHS tapes. Where it really got into the hands of the masses and became viral, so to speak, was when the two filmmakers moved to California. They have a viewing party with a friend of theirs who takes a few copies home. He burns them and gives them to a Los Angeles video store called Mondo Video A Go-Go. It started spreading across the underground like a plague. It was crazy. It was like replicating. And Heavy Metal Parking Lot, a video literally just about Judas Priest fans in a parking lot, ended up being a big inspiration and a tour bus staple of a little Seattle band you might know called Nirvana. Now, the video still spreads to this day from person to person. Now, online, more than anything, you could watch it on YouTube, and it's been followed up with Neil Diamond Parking Lot in 1996 at that same center. Then in 1999, they created Harry Potter Parking Lot because that was as big as Judas Priest in 99. And in 1997, Heavy Metal Parking Lot got its first movie theater screening, despite having been out for almost 10 years before. It's a cult classic to this day, and not bad for two guys slacking off and filming a parking lot. I mean, think about it. I'm not trying to begrudge, but the work versus reward here. Either way, go on screen Heavy Metal Parking Lot to this day. You might see a little of yourself in there, because I know I do. Now, how about a little bit of Judas Priest? And not the parking lot cover, the good stuff this time. Ironic that the song Taking Care of Business was largely made up on the spot and might have possibly been a Beatles ripoff. But irony aside, it was a powerhouse song for Bachman Turner Overdrive, who had this song and the rest of the album BTO 2 go into the top 10 the very first time for the band on June 1st, 1974. And here's what I'm driving at with both of those points here. So Randy Bachman was working on the riff of Taking Care of Business while he was still a member of the Guess Who. And his original idea for lyrics based around the recording technician who worked on the Guess Who's albums, who would take the 8:15 train to get to work. Bachman called the song White Collar Worker and was supposed to be sort of an antithesis to the Beatles' Paperback Writer. But not too much of an antithesis, apparently, because when Randy Bachman played it for Burton Cummings apparently said, "I'm ashamed of you, man. You trying to get the Beatles to sue us?" But Bachman still feels like there's something there. He's like, "I like these riffs, I like this verse, it's just nobody can stand this chorus." So he sits on it for years and years and years until he leaves the Guess Who and makes BTO with Fred Turner. And a couple of serendipitous moments happen. So Bachman's driving to Vancouver for a gig, and he hears radio DJ Daryl B say, "We're taking care of business." And he's like, "Yeah, that sounds pretty cool." But the second thing that happens is, before the gig, Fred Turner's voice gives out. And at the gig, Randy Bachman thinks they're screwed. They try to get through a couple of songs, nothing doing. They slam through a couple of covers, all right. Randy looks over and he says, "All right, Fred, I need you to play the C, B flat, and F chords with me. Just keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and we'll come up with something." And people loved it immediately. So much so that when they finished the song, people kept clapping, shouting for it again, and then they played it for another 10 minutes. They ran back to the studio, retooled it as kind of a workman's anthem meets contrast to rock and roll lifestyle. It's kind of along the same vein of Dire Straits' Money for Nothing, even though that came out a decade later. Randy takes a riff from a 1967 Guess Who prototype song called A Little Bit of Rain, just to break up those three chords in the middle. And boom, you got yourself a workman's anthem, a slacker's anthem, a rock star anthem, but not Stephen Harper's anthem. Randy Bachman had a bit of a beef with him back in 2014 because of the whole Kraft Dinner tariff, and that Canadian artists would have had to have $9,000 worth of streams to purchase a box of Kraft Dinner, which, I mean, fair and valid point. But one more fun fact about Taking Care of Business: it was re-recorded by Curtis Blow on what is to believe to be the first ever rap album. Canadian rock, we had a tiny hand in rap music too. But when it comes to the original, accept no substitutes. Now, let's you and me take care of some business. Had a case of mistaken identity before. You know, you wave to somebody in the grocery store and it's not the same person, and you feel awkward and you kind of want to die inside just a little bit, but you get over it. But I guarantee that mistaken identity has never resulted in you being detained in Russia, except if you're Alex Kapranos, who is the lead singer of the band Franz Ferdinand and was arrested June 2nd, 2005 at the Russian Domodedovo Airport. Now, they were doing a couple of nights in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but they were about ready to leave. They had to go back to New York. They had to record some tracks. But not so fast. They're leaving the airport, and the boop, boop, boop thing goes off when his passport gets run. Turns out Alex Kapranos' birth name is Alex Huntley. That was his mother's maiden name. The problem is, Alex Huntley was also the name of MI6 spy Richard Tomlinson when he was going under an alias doing spy missions in Russia. The Russians, not a fan of Richard Tomlinson or Alex Huntley, because he had taken a bunch of secrets during the USSR days. And the British also weren't fans of him because he then tried to leak those secrets when he wrote a book. Either way, bad news for Alex Kapranos. He gets picked up by big burly guards and taken off to the interrogation room. Now, luckily, it was all sorted out when people realized, hey, these two guys, they look nothing alike. And also, Richard Tomlinson, aka Alex Huntley, is 13 years older than Alex Kapranos, aka Alex Huntley. Apparently, it took a few hours to convince the Russian guards of this. Now, it's all been smoothed over in the meantime. The band has used a lot of Russian avant-garde imagery in their album covers. They keep playing shows there to this day. Hopefully that's just a freak occurrence, because I'm pretty sure Dan Soul is not a fairly commonly named, but I won't find out the hard way like Kapranos did. Really gives Take Me Out a whole new meaning here, doesn't it? Historically, radio edits of a song don't do particularly well in the eyes of fans, especially when they're edited for time. For example, that's why the short version of Derek and the Dominoes' Layla absolutely flopped. Ditto for the first version of Smoke on the Water. That's why Queen fought so hard for the full 6-minute version of Bohemian Rhapsody. Most bands and fans equate shortening a song to stifling art, but maybe not necessarily in the case of The Doors' Light My Fire, which had a hacked and slashed 2-minute 52 second version of the song drop on June 3rd, 1967. Now, when it was released in January, it had kind of flopped because radio stations said, no way you're gonna play a 6-minute 50 second song on the radio. It's too freaking long. But the problem was fans were starting to hear about The Doors. They were calling up radio stations and saying, just play it. So the label starts putting a lot of pressure on producer Paul Rothchild to do an edit. He goes in there, he chops off the keyboards off the top, he chops out the guitar solos, and to most fans and radio DJs, this thing was an abomination. Most jocks wouldn't even play the shortened version. They were just, screw you, I'm gonna play the regular version. But according to Jazz Holman, who was the founder of Elektra Records, the only person who wasn't screaming about this was Jim Morrison, who is directly quoted as saying, imagine a kid in the suburbs of Minneapolis hearing even the cut version over the radio. It's gonna turn his head around. Do it. Release it. We'll send it out with the full version on the other side, radio stations can decide to do what they want. But he may have had an ulterior motive, because in his notebooks, Jim Morrison says he hated the song and hated playing it, especially because it wasn't his poetry. Robbie Krieger had written it. And to add insult to injury here, after The Doors' 1968 European tour, the band made the decision to sell the song to Buick for $75,000 and let them chop and screw it a little bit more with the line, come on, Buick, light my fire. Jim had no part in that. And he comes back after being completely incommunicado in England, throws a fit, goes to Buick headquarters and says, I will smash Buicks in concert on live TV if you ever dare putting this commercial out. So you can see why the guy might be a little bit into some self-sabotage, so to speak. Still, weirdly enough, it was the last song The Doors ever played together on December 12th, 1970, and Jim Morrison smashed his mic into the ground, ending the show halfway through the song. So I'm just saying, perhaps it's a little bit suspect that he was so into a butchered version of the song. But maybe I'm getting a little conspiratorial here.
You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire.
Some people think it is accurate to call The Police's Every Breath You Take a love song. If that's true, then it is the creepiest love song that has ever existed. Or perhaps more accurate to say, not a love song at all. But despite its uncomfortable subject matter, it was The Police's fifth and final number one on the album Synchronicity from 1983. Recorded at the height of the breakup of The Police and also Sting's breakup with his first wife, Frances Tumulty, the song is about an obsessive stalker. Period. Flat out. According to a 1983 interview with the New Musical Express, Sting says, quote, it's a nasty little song, really rather evil. It's about jealousy, surveillance, ownership. The words are sadistic. On one level, it's a nice little song with classic relative minor chords, but underneath there's this distasteful character talking about watching every move. But it wasn't just a marital problem, it was a relationship problem of another source that helped create Every Breath You Take. While Sting was writing this, coincidentally on the same desk Ian Fleming wrote James Bond novels, seriously, in Jamaica at the GoldenEye Estate, it came as Sting was exerting more control, not listening to the rest of the band, and these bitter rivalries and arguments made it clear that the Police were not working together anymore. So aside from being about a stalker, it's also about a breakup of a band. But weirdly enough, they released this ugly and violent song, and it's the number one hit in 1983. It's the biggest song of the year. It beat Michael Jackson's Billie Jean for amount of weeks on the chart, and that is saying something. But the reaction was really weird. People started using it for their weddings, for anniversaries, as radio and karaoke dedications. Sting says he was in fact most creeped out and also greatly amused by when he watched on TV Andy Gibb, the youngest Bee Gee, singing it as a love song classic to some girl, totally missing the point of the lyrics. He says he pissed himself laughing, direct quote. It also got another different interpretation when it was used as the sample beat for the Puff Daddy song I'll Be Missing You, which was a tribute to Notorious B.I.G., but Sting didn't even know he used that until after the song was out, and the royalties paid for Sting's kids to go through college. No hard feelings though, the two are still friends, they've performed it together, and while still not a love song, it is substantially less creepy than the original version. So yeah, think about that one the next time you got a dedication for someone special. Whew. Man, there's truly nothing quite like looking back on the history of rock, especially when you see a little bit of yourself in it, like that first story about heavy metal parking lots there. Hopefully you came out with a little bit more knowledge than you had before, and a little bit more respect of BTO's Taking Care of Business as a Slacker's Anthem, The Police's Every Breath You Take as a Creepy Little Song, and never take the long version of Light My Fire for granted ever again. Because that shortcut, man, that's a gross little listen. As always, I had a blast hanging with you, doing some virtual crate digging and telling some rock and roll stories. If you got a story you want heard on Liner Note Leftovers, always hit me up, 1061 The Goat on various social medias, or you can send me an email, danielmsoul@gmail.com. If you're listening to this on a podcast app, leave a rating because it does a world of difference for the show. It gets it to more people's ear holes, and it makes us bigger, stronger, and better going into the future. I appreciate you coming along. You're always loved here on Liner Note Leftovers. I'll see you in the next one. I guess all there is to say now is, as always, grab life and your vinyl by the edges.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to myloydminsternow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.